I remember when we started the project, and like none of us are farmers. And I soon realized that if I don't build a good, strong team, it doesn't matter how well we do our farming practices, because that's just going to fall apart regardless of our technical capability.
My name's Michelle Grant, and welcome to the Grateful Podcast. It's really wonderful to have you here with us as we chat to women from all around the world who are working to build more just, generative, and even joyful food systems, communities, and lives. And in this episode of the podcast, I'm taking you to the Western Cape of South Africa to explore a really beautiful initiative that's called the Living Soils Community Learning Farm. Now, this initiative is actually a collaborative partnership between some unlikely partners: Woolworths, which is one of the biggest supermarket retailers in South Africa; Spear, which is a wine farm; and the Sustainability Institute, a not-for-profit trust. And these unlikely partners came together with the common mission to try and tackle three really big challenges in the area: youth unemployment, childhood malnutrition, and unsustainable farming practices. And they try and do this through empowering young Black women through work in regenerative farming to grow nutrient-rich food, which helps to strengthen the local community's food security and also create livelihoods in parallel. So it was really a treat for me today to sit down with Riranzu Marivate, who is the person leading this whole initiative. She was born and raised in Gauteng and is now based in Stellenbosch in the Western Cape of South Africa, where she's working as a socio-ecologist and regenerative food systems practitioner responsible for running this Living Soils project. So her background is in environmental management and research, and before joining the Sustainability Institute to run this project, she actually worked with the South African Council of Scientific and Industrial Research, as well as the University of Cape Town. And she's really passionate about agroecology and sustainable food systems and how this can be used to create livelihoods that also protect the environment and build community resilience. And Riranzu was generous enough to talk with me not only about this wonderful initiative, the work that they're doing, but as importantly, how they're trying to do it, how they're trying to collaborate with the team and the community to really embody regenerative leadership while they do regenerative agriculture. Riranzu shared some really interesting insights about how they actually managed to both develop and run a project that simultaneously tackles so many different and big topics that are overwhelming on their own. She also shared a lot about how they try and nurture this special energy that people always seem to notice when they come into contact with this project and with the farm. She mentioned that often people feel the project more than they see it, and there's a lot of work behind that where they also try and center individual and community growth and learning and development while still trying to make a tangible impact on the ground. And I was just fascinated to hear more about how they use regeneration as a lens for their work, not just in producing food, but also in terms of human development. I'm sure you will enjoy our conversation as much as I did, so I wish you happy listening. I thought it would be interesting to hear a little bit more about your background and your connection to food. What are your earliest memories of food or farming?
I think I'm privileged to come from a family who have farming as their background. And even though my parents and grandparents weren't primarily farmers, there was always food growing happening on both sides of my family. My maternal grandfather was a farmer, and so he used to have a farm, and this is where my mother and my uncle were born. And so in his life and his family's life, they moved into a smaller space, but still retained growing of food. And then I think that also translated into myself and my siblings growing up, always being surrounded by food growing activities. I mean, similar to my father's side, they've always maintained farming, even though they were in teaching and medical services. And so I think I'm thankful that my parents met and they decided to continue with the practice of food growing and growing up with quite a lot of opportunities to be able to grow, harvest and consume. I mean, obviously it wasn't fully that because we were also influenced by a lot of fast food as well as more retail access to food. But there was always an element of homegrown food, which I think was connected to a lot of the traditional foods that you don't necessarily see in the shelves. I grew up with the connection of some of our cultural or heritage foods that I always crave any time I'm away from home. And so every time I call my mother saying that I'm coming home, she knows that she has to prepare some of her traditional recipes with the food that they're still growing to this day, that I have the privilege of, yeah, still consuming and just being a child in my mother's house.
And can you describe one of those dishes for me? What would you love to see on the table when you go home?
This is such a great question. It would be ting. And ting is a traditional sorghum porridge. So it's like a stiff porridge rather than like a runny porridge. So you ferment the sorghum grain after you've milled it. And then after a number of days, it becomes really nice and sour. And you can either have it as sort of like a morning porridge for breakfast with some sugar. And so it becomes like nice, sour and sweet. Or the way that I prefer it is if you have it like as a main staple with your savory sides. And my favorite savory sides are chotlo. And chotlo is, yes, it's a Tswana term for really long cooked meat that it not only falls off the bone, but it just basically breaks down, that it just becomes a soupy and just really delicious and very wholesome and very flavorful, like savory side. And it always has to also go with this fermented beetroot that my mom loves. And there's always beetroot in the fridge. There's no way that there's not going to be beetroot at home. And then I also have grown up with making sure that I always have that kind of fermented beetroot in my fridge as well.
Sounds like a really homely dish. And you mentioned sorghum. Is that a crop that you're seeing a return of in South Africa?
It's quite interesting that I didn't even realize it was not as popular. So I think one of the big realizations of that was when I had to relocate to the Western Cape. I didn't mention that I'm originally from Gauteng, Pretoria. And so because we have different cultural backgrounds or ethnicities, each culture has their own staple foods. And so sorghum has played a huge integral role in my upbringing because my mother, as a Tswana person, it's one of their main staple foods. So we've always grown with access to sorghum and we've always had it accessible at the stores and all of that until I moved to the Western Cape, where even within Xhosa speaking community here, they don't necessarily eat it as much and it's not as accessible in these parts. And then so it's also then that I realized that the interest in sorghum has been declining over the years, just in terms of its production and its consumption. And so I'm seeing now more recently, especially in, I think in the last 2 years or so, quite a resurgence in looking at sorghum as a superfood. And I think also food for building kind of resilient futures in the farming and food aspect. So there is a huge uptake of sorghum again. And so I'm very excited because now I get to keep bringing up the fact that sorghum is life. And I get excited when I have to share that heritage that I've grown up with others. It's also quite exciting that this year is marked as the year of the millet. And I think in some aspects, sorghum, also known as the great millet, has been sort of the poster child for that.
Yeah, and it just needed the rebranding that you gave it, I think. Sorghum is life. I can hear as you talk about food, your passion for it, and it's obviously where you're dedicating much of your life now. But I'm wondering if that was always the case. What job did you want to have growing up? And was there a sort of turning point where you ended up going towards food?
It's always an interesting discovery that I've found my way here, because I was not interested in food as a place that I was going to be actively participating in being part of my career. I never thought about it beyond consuming it, so to speak. So my interest growing up, I wanted to be an animal behavior scientist or ethologist, and specifically in primatology. So I had aspirations of being like a Jane Goodall or a Diane Fossey. I wanted to really relocate to East Africa and work with the great apes. I wanted to be a zoologist, and I got to university. And first day of registration, I was told that I could double major in natural sciences. And then I was introduced to geosciences, and in particular geology. It was the first time I've ever heard of it. And I was so fascinated that I was like, oh, okay, this is going to be the thing that I'm going to co-major in. I'm going to do geology, and then I'm going to do zoology. And then so in my undergraduate, I co-majored in both. I think geology was really foundational in me understanding earth system sciences and earth system processes from a very much beyond human time frames and timescales, and really understanding the broader picture. And I feel that if anyone has the opportunity, they should do geology to just really appreciate kind of the scale of Earth and the universe, and just how everything just so intricately is so designed and how it works in order to be where we are. And so I appreciate geology for giving me that frame and really understanding earth processes. And so I think through that, I kind of started undergoing a change in mentality. So before, I wanted to work in the wild, and really it was to be away from people, because I always, people are the problem. So why would I want to work in nature where people are involved? And then through that, I started understanding that people form part of the system. So if you're really wanting to be a true environmentalist, then you have to think about how people form part of the system, and then informs how you look at systems change. So I continued with my postgrad. I wanted to then look specifically at socioecology and environment and society, and then how that goes hand in hand. And yeah, I found myself working in the space as an environmental scientist, looking at people, community management, and natural resources. And I worked for a bit of a time at our National Council of Sciences, the CSIR, which is the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. At the CSIR, I was working with communities and natural resource management, and particularly in environmental management, in helping create accessibility to environmental management services to disadvantaged communities and across South Africa. And I think, yeah, there were a number of realizations through that, one of which was realizing that the environmental management process usually comes right at the end of the feasibility of the development. And so it's always seen as sort of like an afterthought. So when you come in during the environmental assessment, you are trying to minimize impact rather than see opportunities for having positive and maximum impact on the environment. And I felt that that was quite limiting. And I think the second realization was that a lot of the developments that we were working with within these communities were in food and agriculture. And so there seems to be this huge interest of people wanting to be more self-sustaining. And then this is through developing themselves and creating livelihoods in farming. And I think that speaks to just traditionally how we are so attached to land and food. And then so it was a no-brainer for me to see how there can be an opportunity to use food as a lens to have this positive contribution towards the environment through farming. And so this is how I ended up coming back to the food system and me getting this job at the Sustainability Institute.
As a lot of the people listening might not be familiar with the area that you're in, I just wanted to give you a chance to share a little bit more about the context that you're working in. So you mentioned that you've moved now to the Western Cape in South Africa. I've had the pleasure of visiting the SI a few times and running some programs there, and know a little bit about the context you work in, but could you share more about that so that we can understand better, especially in terms of food security and agriculture, the backdrop that your project sits within?
So the Living Soils Community Learning Farm is a project that started 5 years ago now. We are based in Stellenbosch in the Western Cape, which is a part of the Cape Winelands. So there's quite a lot of agriculture. So it's seen as more of a rural area in that aspect. And just in terms of the context in South Africa, we also find ourselves working with communities that come from the farms. And this is mainly the wine farms in our surrounding area. And so we have farm worker communities who you would think that because they work on farms that they have the skills and capabilities and access to food. But unfortunately, that's not the case. And so with a lot of the communities, they're quite food insecure and no access to quite a lot of services and facilities. And so as Living Soils is being part of the SI, the Sustainability Institute, was that the SI wanted to see how it can be a community partner and organization that supports the farm worker communities. And they found that through quality education, you create an opportunity for improving the developmental chances of a lot of the children and youth within the farm worker communities that would ultimately not have had that opportunity. And then a second lens was that you don't just provide quality education. You have to have a holistic picture. And then so there's other aspects just in terms of supporting development that I'm not necessarily well versed in, but I will speak from a food perspective in saying that in terms of supporting the developing brain of a child, you also have to have access to good food and nutrition from a very young age. And so food and nutritional insecurity is quite high in South Africa generally, and it is also true for the communities that we work with. So our mission was to make sure that we increase food and nutritional security. And so part of our job as Living Soils is making sure that we grow nutritious and fresh produce that can be accessible to our communities. So we contribute to the feeding program for the SI. So our produce also goes into those meals and making sure that the children and the youth of the community have access to the food. And thanks to COVID, we were able to do quite a lot in engaging with the households directly. And we identified high risk or at risk households that need continuous support and access to food. Since then, we've been also contributing food to a number of the households that we find are highly food insecure in order to make sure that they receive, you know, sufficient food and that's nutritious as well. And some communities are also not interested in wanting to grow their own food. They just want an opportunity to have a livelihood or an income that enables them to have access to the opportunity to buy food. And I think that's true even in other communities within South Africa.
As I understand it, what you're trying to do with the Living Soils project is really looking at tackling these three things at the same time. So unemployment in the area, unsustainable farming practices, and also the food insecurity that you just talked about. Could you share a little bit more about how the Living Soils, I think the full title is Living Soils Community Learning Farm, how it works, what do you do, who it is that you're working with?
So Living Soils is a partner project, so it's a collaborative project. So the SI is one of three partners, the others being a Speer Wine Farm, where the actual farm is located, and then Woolworths, which is one of the biggest retailers in South Africa. And so they sat down, I think 6 years ago, wanting to see how to engage in addressing food insecurity as well as unemployment, particularly through the youth and community lens, while tackling with the issues of negative impact of agriculture on the environment. And so the partners came together and said that they wanted to see if we can come with a collaborative model where we want to address these three very important pillars in our communities. And so Living Soils was established, and the main goals are to make sure that we are a learning and practicing farm that grows food using ecologically regenerative methods. And this is more sustainable practices of growing food that contribute more positively towards the environment. And that the food that we grow primarily addresses food security within our local community, and using a very much child-centered lens as well, because you know that we have to catch the child as early as possible through making sure that they have access to food so that it impacts them positively on their development even later on in life. And yeah, lastly, then being a platform for training and capacity development with the hope that we are able to capacitate especially young people in food and farming skills so that they're able to use that to get into farming and in the industry and just create a livelihood for themselves. And so that's really the aim and how Living Soils is structured. And through the 5 years, it's been a process of learning as you go and learning from our mistakes and really understanding and adapting to our context. So, I mean, there's quite a lot that has happened and changed along the lines of trying to figure out the most effective and the best way of approaching the implementation of our goals. And so one of them was the realization, I think I'll speak to food security first, was that there were way more children within our local community in Lyndock and Stellenbosch in terms of supporting. Most of the children attend their schooling here at the Sustainability Institute. And then there's need outside of our boundary. And then so we had to figure out then how do we engage with more children and making sure that they gain access to our produce as well. And then that's been a process of learning and knowing where our boundaries are in terms of our capabilities, because in Stellenbosch, there's a huge number of different ECDs, or what we call early childhood development centers. And we have a very small team, and we're not able to go to each and every ECD. And each ECD also has their own set of problems where they might not necessarily have opportunities to be able to store their food. And then so what that means might be that we might need to have to cook the food or make sure that somehow the meal is provided to the children, because there's just really no staff that's available to do that. And then so we realized that it was becoming a bigger scope than we could actually carry as a farm. And then so through the process of really learning and understanding where the challenges are, we then realized that there is an importance in building partnerships within our local community and really being engaged in our local networks. And then so we found more local partners that are already seeking and supporting food security within their own little scopes and communities, and want to partner with them. And so we have a number of organizations that we actually grow food for and distribute the food to them, who then cook the food and then distribute it to those ECDs. And so this is how we indirectly then help with contributing towards that greater picture and the greater good. I think it was a big lesson in knowing that you can't do everything by yourself, but lean in the community and the networks that you have. And I think that was quite a big and important lesson and pivot that we made. The second one was through training and capacity development. So our goal was broad in terms of saying we want to make sure that we offer training and capacity development to young and emerging farmers and the community at large. And with our Lyndock community, it's quite challenging to reach as many people as you'd like. And we decided that we're wanting to approach it differently, so to speak. I mean, the training that we've run has been great and has been, you know, positive in many aspects. But then we had the opportunity right at the beginning as well to collaborate with the Agroecology Academy, which was another program under the Sustainability Institute, where we, as that program was just coming to an end, their last cohort of students were requiring practical and experimental opportunities. And so we decided as Living Soils that we wanted to be that platform of practical learning. And then so we gave an opportunity in 2020, by the way, which was hard, yeah, to 11 young farmers who were about to graduate after that practical year, the opportunity to do their practicals with us in Living Soils. And that helped with us understanding the blueprint of where we fit into that training capacity development in the bigger picture, because we realized that there is a need for supporting young farmers. And so we then decided that we're wanting to really be intentional in supporting youth and youth of color, and mainly women in agriculture, and making sure that they have practical access and opportunities. And coming back to the community as well, so the agroecology interns or students weren't necessarily coming in from the farm worker communities. They were coming in from more broader communities beyond the boundaries of Line Dog. But then we also wanted to see how we can have a different approach to our community support. And so we wanted to work with the youth and created a youth internship program in parallel, after realizing that we have carried a really nice internship program with our student interns. And that has evolved in us supporting youth from the farmer communities, but then youth as well who are coming in from the agricultural sector. And I speak to that in its important area because in South Africa and here as well in the Western Cape, the agricultural colleges usually have like 2 years of theory, and then in your third year it's expected that you as a student have to find your own placement and complete a year of work integrated learning of practical internship. And that becomes quite a barrier of completing your diploma, because a lot of young people of color are not able to find their placements. And then if they do, they're not able to complete them, or they're not in good or safe working environments. And so we wanted to see how we can create an internship that really catches those youth and students to make sure that they are able to finish their internship so that they can graduate as agricultural graduates, so that they can gain access into careers into the sector, but also be intentional in making sure that they get as much learning and development as possible through the internship year. And so that's how we've kind of evolved and who we support as Living Soils.
Wow, it's a beautiful web of connections there that you're I can imagine also juggling on a day-to-day basis. So if I understand well, you have the farm space itself where you do regenerative farming practices that is tended to by the interns and the young farmers as a part of their training program, and it's delivered in quite a holistic way. And then the food that's produced is directed towards children in the community, either directly through the Sustainability Institute and the school and the early childcare there, but also to the broader community through these partners that you work with that can kind of prepare it and then get it more broadly into the children in the community. Did I understand that correctly?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, I think one thing I neglected to say is that we have a core team of wonderful people that form part of the Living Soils project itself. Obviously, myself as the project manager, but we also have a team of farmers that make sure that regardless of whether or not the interns are there or they're in a different learning space, the farm runs fully so that we are continuously producing. And so we're in terms of the farm team, there's 9 people. And what's been really great is that we have 3 farm managers, and then they carry and hold the space in different aspects of farming, from soil and water management is one, food production, and the other being the site manager. And we have another manager who's also a nursery manager, and all 4 of them actually are the initial graduates from the agroecology group of interns and students who basically stepped into more managerial positions to hold and run the farm and the aspect of food production, which has been really great. And then we have 6 farm workers that also then form part of the team in making sure that they hold the space for mainly the production. But what I really enjoy is that the way that we do things on the farm is that we also have a very much holistic and community approach of management and farming. And so it does feel like you're at work because it's physical labor, but it really is about the greater good and the community. And so the way that we work together, we understand that this is our mission, that this is what we need to do. And so we're wanting to be intentional in creating a farm that really supports the growth and capability of each and every individual. And so that's the core team. And we have a training coordinator, Yoli, as well, and a project administrator. And so there's 13 of us all together that's holding the whole project and making sure that all these different pillars of the project are well supported. And then the interns then create the opportunity to make sure that the farm is able to contribute and grow at a greater scale than you can manage.
I think that's so important, right, that we talk not only about what we're doing, but also how we're doing it. And it sounds like that's a very important part of your approach to how it is you work with each other and how you collaborate. If you have to name it specifically, what do you think is unique about how you work together at Living Soils?
Oh my goodness. I always get asked this question because people feel Living Soils rather than see it, because there's just this energy we've managed to create. And what is that? I don't know what to call it, but I think we've been quite intentional in making sure that we create a community. And this is through honoring each individual and making sure that everyone feels seen and heard, and then their ideas have an opportunity to manifest in some aspect of the project. And so I think I would call it one or two things. I think the one is that we have a very empathetic approach to managing and leading. The other one I would call it's creating a regenerative environment. So this is looking at using regeneration as a lens of work. And this speaks to not only thinking about regenerating our soils for food production, but what does that look like in terms of human development as well? And so we speak to regenerative leadership, regenerative learning and education. And I think just regenerative management. And so we're wanting to make sure that our environment is very much nurturing. And I also think that because all the managers are women, and most of our farmers are women, yeah, we only have two guys in the whole team, the core team, it also brings this natural and very organic aspect of this, you know, kind of female energy. And it also helps that many of our farmers and team are mothers. And so they also bring in that nurturing aspect into the project. And it's, I think it's been a process of learning to make that shine so that they feel that they are able to lead from that aspect. And then they, I mean myself included, because I'm from sciences, moving into this type of space, it was very foreign. But then I felt that once you kind of learn to let go in and see how leadership manifests from that perspective of being a woman, of being a mother, and thinking about it as a community, things just tend to kind of show up differently. I don't know if you know Vanessa, who's one of the co-directors here, and she's always asking me to, like, I have to capture our methodology in terms of how we do our leadership. And I'm just like, I don't know. I don't know what it is. I don't know. All I know is I think, yeah, we just be more attentive and just see things just organically grow and just learn to grow from that. And yeah, I don't know how to capture that essence, but I think it's about time because everyone's asking the same question. It's like, really capture this because it's very different. And I'm really hoping that you can visit us again so that you can also get to experience it.
It'll be beautiful to try and capture it in a collective process. It seems like you're working in such a collaborative way to work with the whole team and everybody involved to see how they perceive it and see if through that it crystallizes out.
First and foremost, I will say my team says that I'm not a manager, I'm a leader, so which is great.
I would take that as a compliment.
I take it as a huge compliment. And I think it speaks to how I've decided to define my role. And my role is not to be at the forefront of the project. I'm really a supporting role. So I think what's been most important, firstly, is making sure that everyone understands their role and then understands what the role of the project is, and that everyone buys into that and feels the purpose and contributing towards that purpose. And so I navigate that in making sure that everyone is able to continuously build their capabilities to meet their roles and responsibilities in the project, and in making sure that I support it and I support everyone accordingly. So I really like this leading from the back is kind of what I aspire to and I think that I am. And so this really speaks to how you were saying that it's a very collaborative and a very democratic approach. So I never make the final decision. It's always consultative, and sometimes we have to sit in long meetings to discuss all these things. So we always have, we have opportunities of reflection. We have a very reflective process of how we've been doing, what is not working, what is working, what ideas can we try out, and then how do we continue to keep ourselves accountable to that. And that really helps because everyone feels that they are part of the team, that you're not just being told that you are supposed to do something because, you know, you do it because you know why it needs to be done. And I think that creates the, it creates the self-drive. And yes, the word is agency. It really creates agency in the person to really be fully themselves and then be fully committed to working without somebody pushing you to do that. And that's what we've been successful in creating. And I think that's always been my goal. I remember when we started the project, and like, none of us are farmers. And I soon realized that if I don't build a good, strong team, it doesn't matter how well we do our farming practices, because that's just going to fall apart regardless of our technical capability. So we said that we put that on the back burner. We learn our technical skills as we grow with the project, but what we need to make sure that we have 100% of is making sure that we have that team synergy and building a strong team, and everything else kind of falls into place in time. And so that's been really useful as an approach.
I can imagine another area that calls for leadership is the fact that your project is a collaboration between a winery, a big supermarket retailer, and a not-for-profit sustainability trust, which is kind of unlikely collaborators or unusual partners. So what do you think makes that possible? And what have you each had to adjust along the way in terms of your leadership approaches or collaborative approaches?
I mean, when I stepped into this, I was like, this is quite an interesting configuration of partners. And I'm thankful that at the beginning, all three partners already wanted to be in this collaboration, but it has not been straightforward or been easy, because everyone has their own understanding and agenda in terms of how projects should work. And I think this was also, I think, one of the first of like few cases where it's supposed to be very collaborative and everyone has equal share and say in the project as a partner. And so I think there's been quite a lot of lessons learned in this regard, particularly around learning to let go in certain aspects. As I'm not going to say which partners which, but I think just generally learning to just let go of control, and then really building into the fact that this is greater than just an individual partner. And that has changed in terms of how each partner then gets to step up and step into the project. I think through that, we were able to capture some of the lessons in that. And so appreciating that we always work from a space of context, regardless of what we're trying to solve, and really understanding that. And secondly, also appreciating that co-creation And leadership doesn't just come from the partnership, that also the community, as well as the project team itself, has a voice in making the decisions as well. And yeah, there's so many other ones, but I think those are some of the core lessons that we're trying to make sure that we are accountable to. And then I think right at the beginning as we went, it was also making sure that each partner is accountable to the project by making sure that everyone has homework. So you don't just sit back, but then you're very much actively engaged and involved in the project so that you understand the mechanisms of what the project looks like and how it works on the ground rather than from a high level. A lot of the times we see in a lot of these types of, you know, partnerships, be it public, private partnerships or CSI projects, is that a lot of the time the funder provides the funding and provides sort of like the framework of the project, but then that's about it. And then so they kind of stay in that high tower or upper management, but they don't necessarily understand what it takes for a project to run. And then so we were quite intentional in making sure that everyone is involved so that when we come across challenges, your questions come from a genuine understanding. And that, I mean, took time to get to. And so I think I appreciate the willingness for those opportunities of growth, reflection, and really engaging and being very involved in the project, because that's enabled us to do better as the different project partners, as well as the team. And then to just feel that, I think it's also created this energy of just really wanting to be part of something good, which is so great, because you see the energy and enthusiasm from the partners and wanting to continually contribute and sometimes one-upping each other just so that you can show that you've showed up for the project.
So does that extend to working in the field as well?
Yeah, so there's opportunities where the partners in their different spaces have the opportunity to come and work in the field, and we're always so excited when that happens. And so it's always so funny when you hear, if there's been a long time that they haven't been in the field, that they miss it, which is great.
So I found it really interesting that you were selected as one of the Mandela Washington Fellowship for Young African Leaders recipients. Congratulations, first of all.
Thank you.
I was just wondering how that experience was for you, and what do you think's the biggest change or insight that you got out of it?
I mean, the reason I had applied for the fellowship to begin with was to just really gain more knowledge and understanding of agriculture, and particularly business in agriculture. I think, through what I've spoken about, it's been a journey, and I don't have an agricultural background. And so by any means necessary, I would love to develop that skill. And I feel very honored to have been awarded the fellowship. And we spent time, it was last year already, where we were in the States, and I got to be placed at Purdue University, which is one of the top agricultural universities in the world. And I think just having access to the university staff resources and the exposure that gave was amazing. And I think what was more amazing was to be with other fellow young Africans who are smart and are such go-getters and who are doing amazing work in their different corners of the continent. And I think that was one of my biggest takeaways, to just see how to build that network of supporters, so to speak, and then just really be encouraged in the work that I'm doing, but then also contribute to the work that other fellows are doing, and then just kind of seeing and finding ourselves along the different food value chain and learning from that. I'm really thankful for the fellowship for providing that opportunity. It's also given, I think it's given me a perspective in terms of how the project fits in more on a global scale. Mm-hmm. And then it's also part of the fellowship as well, has been quite a lot of personal leadership development as well. And then that has also helped with building my capabilities as a leader to contribute to the project more positively. And so I was quite excited to be part of the 700 fellows last year and in 50 at Purdue. So to be one of 50 in Purdue contributing towards food systems transformation on the African continent. Yeah, it's been amazing.
So with all of this leadership development, and you also spoke about wanting to kind of embody a regenerative leadership approach in the organization, what's one practice or exercise or thing that you do at the moment that helps you really live into that? Is there, I don't know, no matter how small it is, there a practice that you think helps you bring that to life?
I'm going to speak to two things. I think the one is, and this is, didn't come easy with the team and all, but it's nurturing a growth mentality. And that speaks to being keen and open to always learning and always knowing that you have the opportunity to improve. And then that's something you learn in the big picture stuff and then even the small things in terms of, oh, I could have been planting this slightly differently to how I've been doing it. And just being open to just gaining as much knowledge and information and sharing as well as possible. I think that's one of the things. And then the second is knowing that it's okay to be vulnerable. And then, yeah, just bringing that vulnerability into the work, because I think people appreciate that you are able to bring yourself fully into the space and they see you differently. And that really helps with breaking down a lot of the perceived barriers, so to speak.
So as we're wrapping up our conversation, is there anything you wanted to talk about that I haven't asked you about or anything you wanted to share?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think I just want to say that I'm grateful for finally finding my feet in the food system space. And I think if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't be the person that I am today. I think it's transformed my way of looking, engaging with the world. And then I think most importantly, engaging with people. I mean, I've never necessarily managed people, but I think I appreciate that I've been given the opportunity, and this is like with great thanks to the partners of the project for allowing so much freedom in navigating the management of the project, but then also to the project team and allowing me to be able to lead where there was so much uncertainty as well, that I've learned to really grow. So I'm thankful for the support that I've gotten, because it's given me the opportunity to grow and gain quite a lot of perspective in what it means to be a leader and then what it means to contribute positively in the space of food through community.
And you just mentioned navigating uncertainty. Is there anything really concrete or any tip or something you do every day that helps you navigate uncertainty, which is pretty much the only guarantee in this life?
Yeah, sure. What is it? Just breathe. That's just breathe. And I think just trusting your instinct. That's the biggest thing. I've learned how to trust and listen to my gut more than any other time than through this project, just because of the times you find ourselves and just because of the different layers that the project has, that a lot of times we operate in uncertainty. And many times we know what we need to do, but then we're not confident enough. And even if we don't know what we need to do, your intuition knows how to guide you there. And so I trust my gut more.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful gift that life gives us with experience and time, the ability to do that. So the last question to you is one I like to ask all my guests. What does leading a great and full life mean to you?
Oh, that's a beautiful question. I think it's finding your purpose and living your purpose. So I love the fact that I get to work in a space that fulfills me as the greater person, rather than just feeling like it's a place that I have to go to make a livelihood. And I think also leaning on community and your social infrastructure, and really helps with making sure that you feel whole and supported. and making sure that you're leading that kind of grateful life. And I think just always having gratitude.
Beautiful. That was such a lovely conversation. I feel like it's a project that I absolutely have to come and see in real life as well.
No, please, you must.
Thank you for the work you do. I think it's really important and it's just beautiful the way you show up and do it. So thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity to get to speak about it on your platform. I'm just so much in awe for the work that you do.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of The Grateful Podcast. This is actually the third season of the podcast, so thanks for joining us along the journey so far. We're going to start now collecting guests and insights and topics for season 4. So if you have any ideas at all, please feel free to email them to me at podcast@thegrateful.com. And if you're enjoying the podcast, it would mean so much to us if you could drop us a rating or leave a review wherever you're listening to your podcasts. Looking forward to seeing you all in season 4. Thanks so much for joining us on this journey.